everyone. Thank you for tuning in to the Postmodern Realities podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, Managing Editor of the Christian Research Journal. It is September 2019, and you're listening to episode 141, A Defense of King David's Historicity. On this episode, I'm joined by Dr. Mark Jansen, who has a PhD in history with an emphasis in ancient Egypt from the University of Memphis, and he is also assistant professor of history at Louisiana College and is also the deputy co-director on the Carnac Great Hypostyle Hall Project. You'll have to tell us what that is. Mark has written an article called The Firm Foundations of the House of David, A Defense of King David's Historicity, and it's available free online at our website, equip.org. Mark, it's good to have you on.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
So what is the Carnac Hall Project?
Yeah, it's the Carnac Great Hypostyle Hall Project. And the Hypostyle Hall is a part of Karnak Temple that has these gigantic columns. They're called hypostyles, which are about 70 feet tall. And then we have the concession for that hall plus a little bit of the material around the corner. And so what I'm really working on for the most part is the exterior wall of an adjacent part of the temple that has the battle reliefs from Merneptah, Pharaoh Merneptah's reign, and he's the one who most famously references Israel for the first time outside of the Bible. So he's historically significant for that. And what we're doing is taking the scenes, the like battle scenes in the texts, and scientifically reproducing them in a publishable form so that they're preserved basically forever at that point.
Talk to us about this article that you've written about the historicity of King David, who is mentioned a lot in the Old Testament and is also mentioned in the New Testament in the genealogy of Jesus. So given David's obvious importance in the Bible, especially because he's in Christ's genealogy, why are there some scholars that doubt his existence?
I would say just, you know, try to keep it from being out of hand here, two main reasons are precisely because of the theological importance, and that for some scholars will automatically sort of cast suspicion on the individual in question because it's overly theological and therefore we shouldn't read it as history and that kind of way of thinking. The other reason I think is more germane to what we're trying to accomplish with the article, and that is that they think there's no David because we don't have direct physical evidence of David. There's no contemporary records from his time that speak directly of him, and they claim there's no indisputable physical remains. And that's what the claim is, and what is the basis of this idea that he's not historical.
Well, there's some things that you talk about in your article that I'd like you to kind of expound on so that you can help our listeners understand some of the context of the things that you mentioned. So first of all, what is the Tel Dan Stela and why is it important?
Okay, so the Tel Dan Stela is, I think, probably the most important piece of data we have, at least textual data, on the historicity of David. It is an Aramean victory stela, which means it was a small stone monument with an inscription that an enemy of Israel and Judah set up at Tel Dan, which is the very northern most town in ancient Israel, to brag about his victory over the kings of Israel and Judah in his day, which is about 100, 150 years after David. So there's a lot of really important things sort of already in that, but he sets up the stela, and in the crucial line in line 9, he describes the house, he mentions the phrase, I should say, the house of David. When describing one of the kings he claims to kill, he's Ahaziahu, son of Joram, and I overthrew the house of David. And what's important here is it's an extra biblical mention of David, and it's from an enemy. So if it was an Israelite or Judean king, I can kind of hear the skeptics now. Well, they have an agenda. They want to, you know, validate or justify their rule, so they're appealing to their mythic past. But an enemy of Israel and Judah would have no reason to describe the king of Judah as from the house of David unless he knew that there had been a dynastic founder named David. So it's actually really great that it's an enemy that wrote this. And he's using House of David just like we would use House of Windsor, right, for the British monarchs. There's no other clear meaning for this phrase than, oh, someone who founds a dynasty. And so I think it's really, when they found it in 1993, the fragments in 93 and 94, I should say, it really set off a firestorm of articles on it, because it was so directly, obviously, referring to David that the detractors really had a hard time scrambling for a different meaning for it. But I think it's consensus, for all but the most radical view, is that this definitely says House of David. So what does that all add up to? It means an enemy's claiming David founded a dynasty within 200 years of David's death.
Well, that is fascinating that the Tel Dan Stela was written by an enemy of Israel and Judah. So why is that significant? I mean, obviously, besides the fact that it was an enemy of Israel and Judah.
So the fact that it's an enemy means that David's name had some fame to it as well, right? Because anyone could say, oh, well, you know, we live in the U.S., so we know about George Washington. But so do people living in France, right? Because that's a famous historical figure. In Haziel, that's the author of the Tel Dan Stela, in his day, David was famous enough that he had heard of him. And so famous was David that they, in fact, the enemy just calls Judah the House of David. And this is something the ancients do quite a bit. For instance, the ancient Assyrians, who are in northern Mesopotamia, they refer to a lot of the places they conquer as the house of personal name X, who they say founded the dynasty. So actually, this is a standard ancient practice. And it's, again, really excellent evidence that David existed and founded a dynasty.
Do you think there's limits to something like the Tel Dan Stela? In other words, how much can it really tell us? And should we take care not to overstate our case based on this one document about the historicity of David? Like, in other words, if they affirmed he existed, do we only look at that? Or does that over, you know, how do we balance that?
It is really important that, and I really want Christians who are serious about thinking deeply about these kind of things to recognize the limitations of the data, because we so often will get ourselves into trouble, especially with academians, by overstating the case, right? So this proves sort of a bare minimum set of things, that David existed according to an enemy and founded a dynasty. It doesn't say anything about various details in the Bible, right, for which it's probably unreasonable to expect proof. How could you prove the story of David and Bathsheba? Or even David and Goliath, like archaeologically, would be next to impossible to prove, like beyond a shadow of a doubt. So this is really important data, but it does have sort of a threshold as far as what it can really tell us. And I think it's important, too, to recognize that I think sometimes we have to take things on faith as well. And so we're talking about the broad historicity, and we're talking about plausibility and things like that, rather than always having definitive proof. And if we act like we have definitive proof, I think it's pretty easy to pick those kind of arguments apart and make us look silly. So it definitely has its limits, but I do think it establishes beyond any reasonable doubt that David existed.
Now, you also mentioned something else in your article, so I'd like you to explain that for us. So what is the Mesha Stela, and why is that important?
So the Mesha Stela, and for your readers, it's also sometimes called the Mesha Inscription, is another inscription from an enemy ruler that appears to have the phrase House of David in it on line 31, which is basically just talking about an area that he says the House of David dwelt in, meaning land that the House of David conquered that Mesha wants to go take back. And this one's a little bit more disputed by scholars, but again, the idea is using House of David as a description of Judah, or just like saying King of Israel, saying someone is of the House of David, is the ruler of the region. Here, House of David is just saying that David's line occupies this area. So again, if there's no historical David, who are they referring to? And what does the word mean? There's nothing else that makes sense. Some scholars, I don't touch on all this in the article for spatial reasons, but some scholars think it's a deity named Dod, like D-O-D, or Dodd, only there's no god known as that anywhere in the entire ancient Near East. And it's a good example of sort of gymnastics people will do in light of these inscriptions to get away from the idea that David existed. It's like, okay, you can either say, here's a king in the Bible with this name, and here's two inscriptions that have the same name, or we can make up a god. Right? It's a very curious thing to do as a scholar when it seems pretty plain that it's House of David, just like House of Windsor. So it's a lot like the Tel Dan Stela, the Mesha inscription, that is, but not quite as precise.
So you also mention in your footnotes a new scholarly article by various scholars, including Israel Finkelstein. And it's called Restoring Line 31, the Mesha Stela. So what is the importance of their article?
Well, I just wanted readers to be aware of this for sort of for balance sake and thoroughness. They are claiming it doesn't say House of David at all in the Mesha inscription or Stela, but that it says something about Balak or Balak, House of Balak instead. And this, I think, is, again, doing some gymnastics here to get away from the simple reading of David. And it is very recent, like this summer. It will take a while for scholars to really react to that. And so that's why I don't have a good counter article, because it's not out there yet. But I think it is worth noting for listeners and readers both that no one who wrote that article is a trained epigraphist. In other words, trained in analyzing the language on a stone monument and deciphering the letters. And so epigraphers that you can find little quick reactions online and a couple that have posted like little blog type entries are basically saying, I don't think they're right. But we'll still get more of a scientific study to really confirm that. So I think most epigraphists are not buying it. And the original scholar who said it did say House of David is a world-renowned French epigrapher. So I don't think this theory is going to hold up in the long run.
You're listening to the Postmodern Realities Podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest is Mark Jansen. He has written an online exclusive article for the Christian Research Journal. It's completely free to read it at our website, equip.org. And his article is called The Firm Foundations of the House of David, A Defense of King David's Historicity. And we'd like to invite you to subscribe to the Christian Research Journal. Subscription is $33.50. And I'd like to invite you specifically because if you value the research of our journal, your partnership with us ensures that this resource is here for you, that this free podcast, Postmodern Realities, is here for you, that all of the audio resources and video resources and the Bible Answer Man broadcast and the Hank Unplugged podcast and this podcast, Postmodern Realities, is here for you all the time, 24/7 at equip.org. And we can only provide all of these equipping resources with your financial partnership. And, you know, maybe you can't afford this month a subscription of $33.50, but you might be able to support us with a different amount, something that's right for you, something that you can afford. So if you can give us a tip for some of our articles that you read on equip.org, I like to invite you to do that. So how you would find that link is you go to our website, equip.org. You go to magazine. At the drop-down menu, you'll see PMR podcast. Go to that. You'll see a landing page for this episode for the Historicity of King David. And if you click on that link, go to the landing page, you will find a place where you can give us a tip. It could be something like $3 if that's all you can afford. Maybe that means giving up a latte or something similar, a snack or lunch out for the month, or $5, $10, whatever you can afford. We would be so grateful because it's because of your financial partnership and because you like this resource and want it to be here for you on a weekly basis that we need you to partner with us. So thanks. Well, one of the things that you mention in your article is that the kingdom that King David founded is best understood in geopolitical terms as a secondary state. So can you tell us a little bit and explain to us what a secondary state is and why does it matter regarding the, you know, proof of David's historicity?
So a secondary state, it sounds like it's maybe too, you know, technical or political science theory or something, but I think it makes a really simple point for us. Secondary states typically develop in the shadow of a more primary state. So, for example, in the ancient Near East, the primary states are Egypt and various powers in Mesopotamia, right? The big cats of history that have the real strength. But those places are in decline precisely when David, according to the biblical record, carves out his kingdom. So the cats are away, the mice will play scenario. And secondary state having this opportunity requires the primary state to have experienced some sort of decline or to essentially not be paying attention to what was once all their empire. And this is actually exactly what happens with David, as Egypt has declined by this point, and the Assyrians have not yet reemerged to control the region, which they will do later on in the Bible. Talks about the Assyrians a lot, going to war against the northern kingdom especially. So David fits in this like perfect window. It's almost like God's perfect timing for him to actually believably have a chance to make his own kingdom, because in the eras previous to and after, he would have to go up against the big cats. And at the time that he does live, he's actually just about as powerful as any of them. And so it's, again, that kind of perfect timing.
Well, I would think that not only scholars, but lay people probably are thinking that in any excavations of Jerusalem, that was where David had his capital, you know, they would prove that he reigned at a certain time and, you know, would reveal more about his kingdom. And mm-hmm. So you mentioned that they haven't. So why haven't they?
Well, Jerusalem's tricky to dig. It's certainly true that one of the starting points, right, to be like, oh, let's prove the Bible or prove David and Solomon's kingdom existed, would naturally be to start excavating Jerusalem. And of course, that's been done by numerous archaeologists over the last, you know, 100 years. But Jerusalem is still occupied, for starters. Anytime you have modern occupation, you are going to disturb the material. And it's, of course, not as easy to get access to the data. You might be talking about digging someone's home, right? Their basement. I mean, there's really just obvious logistic issues there. Secondly, the part of the hills that make up Jerusalem that David's capital was on is also subject to quite a bit of erosion, which means archaeologically a lot of the data would be washed out and no longer obviously in a clear time period, right? So when you do a typical dig, you set up your square that you're going to dig and you dig straight down through different layers, different time periods of human occupation, and you have a clean idea of the sequence. If there's too much erosion, that just gets all churned up and you can't really tell. To try to make a technical thing not too technical there. And so with Jerusalem eroding somewhat where the city of David would have been, that does make it difficult. And then, you know, sort of the elephant in the room when you're talking about Jerusalem and the city of David is modern politics and religion, right? Where Solomon would have built the temple, where they would have expected their palaces and so forth, we have the Temple Mount and the Dome of the Rock. And we need to be realistic here. We're never going to dig there, right? Like, that's just not going to happen without launching a global catastrophe. So some of that stuff is probably just forever lost. There are some intriguing finds that they do think associate with the city of David, depending on the scholar you ask. And that's where the debate comes in. But they have found some evidence of some monumental building, like some large enough buildings that you would say, okay, this is not just any old person. Somebody with a lot of power is building these sort of administrative buildings, which I think are probably dated to the time of David and Solomon. But again, it's not definitive. And so we want to be careful there. But yeah, Jerusalem is just very difficult to actually precisely have a clear like proof of David. Instead, we get these suggestions of plausibility again.
So if there's logistical issues to do excavations in Jerusalem, is there other archaeological sites that, you know, would provide existence of King David?
That didn't used to really be the case. It was very debated. There's been over the years a big to-do in the academic world and the archaeological world about these gates that are supposedly Solomon, and then now revisionists say, no, it's Omri and Ahab, that like places like Megiddo and Gezer. But now, leaving that debate aside, it's very technical and probably not likely to be sorted out anytime soon. There's a smaller site that I think shows more evidence of David archaeologically than any other city so far or town. And that's a place called Kiryat Kayafa, which has been excavated by an Israeli scholar named Yosef Garfinkel. And what they found there is really interesting because it's like he's got all sorts of sort of table legs to make this case, right? It's on solid footing here. First of all, the town itself of Kiryat Kayafa is on the border of ancient Judah and the Philistine region, which, of course, readers of the Old Testament know David is constantly fighting and interacting with the Philistines. So it's in the kind of place that you would expect David to have an interest of putting a fortified settlement, right? Because he's got to keep an eye on the Philistines. It also overlooks a very lucrative trade route. Doubly perfect location, in other words. And then they found through the excavations, and this is really important, no one lives there. The place is eventually abandoned, so they get a really nice, clean site to work with. They found evidence that is very, very much in keeping with things the Judeans/Israelites are doing that are unique, like the way the walls were built with the houses butting up against them, like the back wall of the house is the city wall's inner wall. They don't eat pig bones. In thousands of bones from the site, there's no pig bones. Well, who's the only culture that has a prohibition against eating pigs? If it's a Philistine site, we would expect them to eat pigs like they do everywhere else. Right? So these are like, that's like a little ethnic marker that fits the command not to eat pigs in Leviticus. And there's also a great big administrative building right in the middle of town that not just any person would build, that is evidence that somebody that's a ruler or has a lot of power is building this much larger structure. And so he's got things like that that demonstrate, hey, somebody here is ethnically distinct from his neighbors, the Philistines or the Canaanites, and he's doing a lot of things that we would expect a king to do with a fortified wall and a giant administrative building. Who lived in the time period in this area that would do that? Where do we have any other evidence of someone like that? Well, the only answer is, of course, David. But we don't have something like David was here in an inscription there. But I do think it's clear evidence of that secondary state leader's activity. And again, the only candidate is David. And then lastly, and this is a super long answer, but lastly, they have radiocarbon dates that date to David's life, not a later king. Like the radiocarbon dates fit David, not say Ahab or Omri or some later king.
Is there anything else specifically about Kiryat Kayafa that points to David as its ruler?
No, there's no, he hasn't found an inscription or anything direct. There's a few other like really interesting things that are kind of sort of Judean or Israelite in nature, like the cooking pot they used and things like that, that you see scattered throughout Judean sites that seems unique to them, like it's a unique part of their material culture. But yeah, it'd be great if we could get something that's also inscriptional. But what we're trying to do here overall with Kiryat Kayafa is take a look at somewhere where the archaeology shows major planning and state formation in the time that David lived. And then we sync that up with the available textual record. It would be better for sure if Kiryat Kayafa also supplied a text like that, but so far it doesn't. But having talked to Dr. Garfinkel about it, like he thinks there's a chance that that administrative building is somewhere where David could have actually stayed the night, right? Like as when he goes to check on the kingdom and the borders of the kingdom and so on. But yeah, definitive proof on something like that is not there at the moment.
So if there were people who were questioning, you know, the existence of King David as just a myth, because the Bible is a myth, do you think that this evidence that you talked about today, you know, does really show that in the archaeological record that he probably did exist, even though there's not a specific, you know, document that states that?
Yeah, I think the best way to phrase this, if people are trying to like have these conversations with someone who's very skeptical, is to say more and more we're able to make a stronger and stronger case about David. So like when I was in grad school, they'd found the Tell Dan Stela, you know, like 10 years ago, and it was a big deal, and it was like the main talking point in this conversation. Then I work in a Cure But Kaafa begins, and now in the last couple of years, that's been published. And it's like, okay, now this idea that, you know, what some of the skeptics had said is, no, the Israelites and the Judeans, they're just not strong enough to do the things David's describing yet. They're too small scale. And now Cure But Kaafa saying, now hold on, they're absolutely building huge walls and large buildings in this time period. And so you could maybe still be a skeptic about it being David, but you don't have any other candidate, right? So, I mean, what's a better answer saying, okay, this other ancient text, the Bible, and another couple, Tell Dan and the Mesha inscriptions, reference this guy named David. And from the radiocarbon dates at Cure But Kaafa, we know that this site is active and these major monumental features are built during the same time that David would have reigned. Right, it's more like you're connecting the dots. And if you don't think it's David, I don't think you have a better candidate. So if you don't have a better candidate, why are you skeptical about the one name we do have? You see the point? They're just skeptical to be skeptical. And I don't think that really passes muster academically. There's nothing there. It's just being difficult. So, but a lot of this is fairly recent data, and so it'll take some time for it to really, other than Tell Dan, make an impact. But I think Cure But Kaafa is really, really interesting on a lot of levels for those of us that are trying to show that what David does is plausible.
Well, finally, I want to end with some fun rapid-fire questions for Mark. And you recently moved to Louisiana, so gumbo or a po' boy sandwich?
So far, I'd have to say gumbo, but I need to try a few more places for a po' boy because the school cafeteria here has fantastic gumbo. So shout out to them.
And when it comes to home projects, are you DIY or would you rather hire a professional?
Depends how complicated it is. Like painting, stuff like that, I'm totally fine doing it myself, something simple or smaller scale. But if it's going to be something that I'm going to be like, oops, I screwed that up and now I'm going to be paying for it even more in a couple of years, I'd rather just have somebody who knows what they're doing go ahead and do it right the first time.
Would you rather do laundry or wash dishes?
Does doing laundry also include folding? Like you start to finish, I'll take the dishes.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah.
I think that's part of the warp and woof of laundry.
Be part of it, right?
Well, I'll have to ask you the quintessential question of if you are sitting next to two people in history, living or dead, at a dinner party, who would you like to be seated next to?
Okay, that's always a fun one. I want to say Ramses the Great just because I'm a trained Egyptologist and I want to know if he's as arrogant and sort of insufferable seeming as he makes it out in the inscriptional evidence, right? Like he's all about himself. But I'm afraid if he is, it would just be like a super boring dinner party topic, right? So I will have to say, man, all of history is tough. I'll keep it to ancient. I think it would be really interesting to actually have dinner with somebody who's considered to be notorious, right? Like what's Nero really like, the Roman emperor? I'm going to pick Nero on the notorious side, and then I'm going to say Peter the apostle because he gets such a bad rap, right? Kind of act like he's the disciple who's a bumbling idiot, but yet he writes two brilliant epistles in the New Testament. So I think it'd be fascinating to pick his brain and also ask him what it was like wandering around with Jesus.
That would be a very fascinating side of the dinner table where you're seated there. Well, thanks, Mark, for being a guest on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
All right. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Postmodern Realities podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest has been Mark Jansen, and he has written an online exclusive article for the Christian Research Journal. You can find it for free at our website, equip.org, and it's called The Firm Foundations of the House of David, A Defense of King David's Historicity. We'd like to hear from you, so connect with us on social media, like the Bible Answer Man Facebook page, and follow CRI, Christian Research Journal, Hank Hanegraaff, and the Bible Answer Man on Twitter. And please subscribe to the Bible Answer Man channel on YouTube. If you like this episode, please subscribe to the Postmodern Realities podcast on iTunes, and please rate and review our podcast. When you rate and review our podcast, it helps others see our content. And please share this episode on your social media accounts. Be sure you tune in daily to the Bible Answer Man broadcast hosted by CRI President Hank Canagraff, who answers your questions live on air. To ask Hank a question, call 888-ASK-HANK Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. In addition, head to iTunes and subscribe to Hank Unplugged, Hank's audio podcast. Follow Hank off the grid, where he has in-depth conversations with some of the brightest minds discussing topics you care about. So until our next Christian Research Journal author conversation, thanks for listening to the Postmodern Realities podcast.